Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, the views of our guests, and certainly the views of our callers. At our telephone number, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, that's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295, that's 464-8295. But please hold your calls for the time being. We have with us Annie Jacobson, and Annie is a writer. She's written all sorts of articles for all sorts of magazines, but she's written a fascinating book called Terror in the Skies, and we've asked her to come back with us because there's some new information. New information's coming out all the time, and she is being contacted by people in the airline industry and people who work for the government but don't dare come forward themselves, talking about the fact that if there really is a war on terror, why we are not as protected as they would like us to believe. In fact, recently, the government changed the requirements, or at least the specifications for things you can take onto a plane. Now, you remember right after 9-1-1, my goodness, you couldn't have a nail clipper, you couldn't have a knitting needle. I mean, they were doing everything to, you know, inspect everybody, and then suddenly, just recently, they've changed all those requirements, and it's all right now to have 4-inch pointed scissors there, wonderful tool, or a 6-inch screwdriver, sharpen the end of that, you could certainly kill somebody with that. And the question is, if we're really involved in a war on terrorism, why in heaven's name have they suddenly just almost overnight, as if somebody had just said, well, come on now, we're just not going to be worried about this anymore? And of course, if there really is a war on terrorism, I think that we should do everything to really protect our people. Annie, what are your thoughts?
Well, first of all, I just love your introductions, and I couldn't agree with you more. I mean, and I don't mean to laugh. I laughed there when I heard you say 6-inch screwdrivers, because it's, you know, if it wasn't so tragic, it would be funny. That the Transportation Security Administration of the United States of America thinks it's necessary for its passengers to bring a 6-inch screwdriver on the plane. I mean, what on earth for? And this is, of course, after the American public has gotten used to the fact that we need to take security seriously on planes, and they've, you know, committed to giving up their nail clippers. To change the rules doesn't make much sense, but I do like to say the TSA is very good at coming up with bad ideas, and this is their worst.
I think that's it. I wonder if they're going to give me back my nail clippers they took back there in 2001 and 2002. Well, anyway, of course, you've been on the front lines of this battle. Why don't you sort of introduce yourself to our listeners? They may not know who you are, and they might not know certainly about the book you've written. So why don't you give our listeners just a little bit about it? Who is Annie Jacobson, and why is she qualified to write about this?
Well, you know, a year and a half ago, I wasn't writing about terrorism at all. In fact, I was a journalist writing primarily about business and finance for a webzine called womenswallstreet.com, which I still write for, only now I have a regular column on aviation security, and I also have another column. And the reason why is because I myself was involved in the most unfortunate event last summer on a plane in America that I believe was a dry run for a terrorist act.
All right, fine. Well, we're going to bring some other stations on board. So I want to just sort of hold that, because I want you to explain to them what happened. And the listeners, well, you're just going to have to keep on there. We'll be back in just a moment with Annie Jacobson. Her book, Terror in the Skies. We've actually carried the book. We think it's an important book. It's got a great message. So you remember our number? It's 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. Because America truly is at war today. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, and our guest is Annie Jacobson, and certainly she's my favorite guest. We've had her on four times anyway, I can think of now, and she has written a wonderful book called Terror in the Sky. Well, not necessarily wonderful, but a very interesting book. It's a great book, but it's a terrible thing to think about that in this day and age, there could actually be trials and plans for hijacking of our plane still. And as I was simply pointing out a little earlier, you will be pleased to know that the Transportation Agency has changed the requirement for getting onto the plane. Now, before, you couldn't bring on your nail clippers, you couldn't bring on a knitting needle, you couldn't bring on anything. Now, you'll be glad to know you can bring on your 4-inch sharpened scissors. You can bring on a 6-inch screwdriver, because the government has decreed it's perfectly safe, you know, to have these on the plane, whether you're a hijacker or not. It's, everybody's got to be treated equally. So you pick up the story. Now, Annie has written a book because she had an incident last year that changed her life forever. So you pick up the story.
Well, there I was last summer traveling with my husband and young son on a domestic flight, Detroit to Los Angeles. Just expected it to be, you know, just a regular old flight like we normally have. It was not, because also on the flight were 14 Syrian men who acted in a way during this 4.5-hour flight that led me to firmly believe the flight was going to be hijacked. Later, I would discover, when I wrote about this, when it became world news, and I would be suddenly contacted by dozens of federal agents and pilots and flight crew, I would find out that, in fact, this was much more likely a dry run for a future terrorist attack. And not only that, equally as alarming, these dry runs have been going on ever since 9/11. They continue to go on. The government doesn't want you to know about them, and doesn't appreciate my book, Terror in the Skies.
And, of course, there are people who work in the air marshals, there are people who are in pilots, or there are people who are even in government agencies who are very concerned about this and want the message to get out, but it's not getting out.
Well, you know, the air marshals are really alarmed, and I was asked the other day what is the single most alarming element of all this, and here's what it is. Air marshals, and this is why many of them contact me. I have become a bit of a clearinghouse to pass this information on both to the public and also to member of Congress, because, of course, federal air marshals are prohibited from speaking with anyone, any member of the press. But air marshals are concerned that terrorists are targeting them. And that is a serious concern, and here's why.
Hold that thought. We're going to just bring our station right back with us. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here, and of course Annie Jacobson is with us, her book Terror in the Skies, which we do carry. But Annie was just saying that air marshals have contacted her, people contacted her, because she wrote a book, and when you write a book you become an expert, and people who are concerned on that issue really want to unburden themselves. And so air marshals are contacting Annie and telling of their concern, because they have nobody else to go to. They can't go to the media. If they did, they'd be out of a job tomorrow. So they go to Annie to hope that she'll get the message out. And the air marshals are concerned because they fear that the terrorists will target them. You pick up the story there.
Well, the reason that they're so concerned, and this is, of course, before the TSA decided to let handheld weapons back on planes, which I like to refer to screwdrivers and sharpened knives as handheld weapons, because they really are that. But the air marshal's concern is this. And if a group of terrorists is able to identify who an air marshal, have a very grave situation on your hand. They don't need to have screwdrivers, and then you would have an extremely deadly situation. And air marshals believe that they are being scoped out, and this is a serious concern. And they also believe that their own bureaucracy within the Federal Air Marshal Service is not heeding the call and taking care of this matter. And that's very alarming and very disturbing to me. And if you look at the situation I was on Flight 327, and you can imagine that 14 Syrian men, and I attest to this because I was there, are allowed to walk up and down the aisles counting passengers, to block and in groups, and to essentially far more control of the plane than the flight crew, really makes you wonder how difficult it would be for them to overtake the air marshal.
And of course, one of the stories that you tell, you know, is that here, of course, you and your husband are very, very concerned about. And the captain gives the instruction, go and get in the seats and, you know, stow things and, you know, put on your seatbelt. We're about to land. All of the Syrians, or many of them, get up and in unison start going to the bathroom. The order is for everybody to remain in the seat. Do you want to tell that story? Because I really thought that was really so demonstrative of what it was, almost as if it was all being staged.
Absolutely. And you know, the thing is, it's just backing up to the moment that we hit 15,000 feet and the seatbelt finally, that's where the 14 Middle East talking about the cabin as if they had rehearsed talking to one another. But really, most of them spending long periods of time in there. Willie doesn't bring into the bathroom. Objects, especially on an FBI aviation circular for flight crew to look out for. This is, you know, flight crew was told to look out for groups of potential terrorists that would be bringing cell phones, cameras, and bags into bathrooms so as to assemble a bomb in the aircraft bathroom. I know this sounds like a spy novel. I mean, if I hadn't been on that flight and if I haven't read those information circulars, which one in my book, you would really think that this couldn't be possible for the FBI to be aware of this kind of time, allow Flight 327. And yet that is what happened. And making the situation even more confounding is the fact that when Flight 327 landed at Los Angeles Airport, after, as you so eloquently described, seven of the Syrians sin and used the bathrooms consecutively after one another, of course they were the only people standing at that point, you know, as we are landing in Los Angeles, and if you can imagine that we were met by dozens of federal agents as we were, and these federal agents questioned the men for only 5 minutes and let them go, then you really have to wonder what is going on with our Department of quote-unquote Homeland Security.
And of course the thing is that didn't they question you and your husband for what, an hour or something like that?
Well, my husband and I gave sworn statements to the FBI for almost 2 hours. I mean, did the whole, you know, raise the right hand, swore to tell the truth, the whole truth and nothing but, which is why all of the facts of Flight 327 became so crystallized for me and have remained so, because I did give an oath that I was telling the truth. And it was very important to me to be extremely clear and specific in detail of what I had seen, as was my husband. And of course, all of my facts in my sworn statement to the FBI remain, but that didn't stop the FBI from pointing the finger at me after the flight landed and saying that I had overreacted, and they even went so far as to say that I was actually the cause of alarm on the flight at one point.
And, of course, if there was nothing to be concerned about, why did they have all the FBI agents there? And didn't actually the FBI agents had to meet the flight, but didn't the stewardess tell you that they were very concerned, or tell your husband that they were very concerned when he went to them?
Absolutely. You know, absolutely. And I talked to, you know, when my husband went to speak to the lead flight attendant, and she pulled him into the first class galley and said, you know, we are aware of what is going on. We are very concerned. We are watching the men. She told my husband that the pilots had been made aware of the situation, and then she revealed that there were federal air marshals on board. And so there's no doubt that the flight crew was concerned. There's no doubt that the situation was extremely tense. I believe that part of the reason the flight crew didn't, you know, address the men firmly and tell them to sit down is because they were as scared as I was. And of course that's my opinion, but the situation was really volatile up there. I mean, 14 men is no small number.
And especially with Middle Eastern men, and they're simply not behaving normally. In fact, you even describe one of them, just before the plane lands, comes, and one of the people is sitting next to your husband, and one of them comes down the aisle, and when, what happens?
Well, he was the last man to come out of the bathroom. There had been seven in the bathroom at this point.
They went to the bathroom right next to where the cockpit is?
They went to the bathroom at the front of the coach class cabin, which is directly in front of where my husband and I were sitting. So, I mean, they were not 3 feet from me. And so I watched them very specifically, and two of them were doing squat thrusts in front of the emergency exit door as they spoke in Arabic to another man who was seated just next to my husband, and the others were in the bathroom. And there was also a set of three or four in the very back bathroom. So they had the two bathrooms covered. They were using the two bathrooms. You've got the loud Arabic going on. You've got the leader reading from a small red book. And you've got all of them speaking Arabic. And you've got me thinking, wow. You know, last man comes out of the bathroom, passes by the man who's reading from the small red book, and makes a slashing motion across his throat and mouths the word no. They all sit down, and the flight lands safely.
And I'm sure you breathed a sigh of relief at that time, but then, of course, you are being criticized for the FBI, but, and all you had done was simply reported your concern to the stewardess.
Well, you know, it was simply too much for the Department of Homeland Security to handle. And, of course, I naively thought at the time, like, I didn't understand the giant enormity of the political situation that was going on. But the 9/11 Commission report would be released in only a few more days after this story broke. And, of course, we can be sure that the Department of Homeland Security officials knew what was in that report. And we can be sure that they knew that the finger was going to point very squarely on federal officials and all that wasn't done. And so to have a situation happen like 327 that was clearly so at odds with the nation being safe and the nation feeling safe was not something that anyone wanted to become news. And I write about this in the book. And that is why, I mean, on the very day that I was on CNN, the 9/11 Commission report was released saying it was a failure in intelligence. It was a failure of federal agents to communicate with one another. That is what the report was saying about the events leading up to 9/11 and the state of affairs in the federal government. And then you had a federal government presently last year saying, but we have changed all that. We have this wonderful Department of Homeland Security that has these incredible lines of communication through all its different agencies. And yet Flight 327 illustrated that was very far from the case.
Now, one of the things I thought that was so fascinating is later on, you were actually contacted by people from the Office of Homeland Security, and they told you of a flight just about, what was it, a week or several weeks before the 911 attack. Would you like to tell that story? Because I think it's so pointed about and
you
so
bet.
Important.
You bet. Once 327 happened, many bloggers got onto the story, and a lot of people wrote about it, and it was reported in newspapers all over the world. And one of the things that was brought up was a story that I had previously not heard of prior to Flight 327, and that is the story of James Woods, the Emmy Award-winning actor, and it goes like this. But the blogosphere knew about this, and they reported on the similarities. And what happened with Woods was he was on an American Airlines flight from Boston to Los Angeles. Now, that's the same flight path and same carrier that would be hijacked on 9/11. Woods was on that flight in August of 2001, and he was sitting in first class. And it sounds like we'll come back to that.
All right, fine. Well, and of course, he's sitting in first class, and he notices some strange activity there, and I'll let Annie describe all of this. But you know, he reported this. He was very concerned about it. This was about a month before, just a few weeks before the September 11th attack. But of course, he was did everything he could to report it, and nobody wanted to hear the story that he was concerned about an Arab hijacking the plane he was on. So we'll get to this story in just a few minutes here at Radio Liberty. All right, Annie, why don't you go ahead and tell the story about Mr. James Wood?
Well, Woods was on the flight. Also on the flight, sitting in first class, were four Middle Eastern men who he felt were going to hijack the plane. And he was so alarmed that he told the flight attendant. The flight attendant told the pilot. This was back in the day when the pilot would actually come out of the cabin, talk to concerned passengers. And the pilot said to Woods, "What's going on?" Woods said, as he would later tell the New Yorker magazine in an interview, "You know, I am so concerned that these men are going to hijack this plane, And I understand what a serious, complaint this is. I mean, he was not being an alarmist. He was very, very concerned. The pilot said, thank you very much. We'll make sure to lock the cockpit door. But Woods said an interesting thing, and that was that he kept his metal cutlery with him after the dinner was taken away. The flight landed safely, and Woods later would find out that the pilot actually filed a report with the FAA on his behalf about this unusual behavior by four Middle Eastern men sitting in first class. But no one followed up with James Woods, and no one followed up with the four Middle Eastern men. Now, 9 months after Flight 327, when the federal agents came to interview me, because they were investigating Flight 327 still, and they still are, the lead agent said to me, when I said, you know, I just want you guys to realize that I had not even heard of the James Woods incident before this flight. I didn't know anything about terrorism. These were just fresh eyes I was using and looking at here. And the lead agent pulled up his chair. He sat down and he said, Annie, Mohammed Atta was on James Woods' flight. Now, that had never been publicly revealed before. It had been speculated, but it had not been revealed because Woods himself said that he believed his testimony was going to be used at the trial of Zacharias Moussaoui. And so in the agents telling me this, I believe it was a bit of a wink and a nod saying, there's nothing wrong with trusting your instincts. I think it's our instincts that are extremely important, and I think that it's our instincts that are going to do a much better job for us than any kind of political correctness.
And I think that the difficult thing is that many times people who work within government are hampered and prevented from doing what is right.
Absolutely. You know, and when you add, and now that in and of itself is a bit of a shocker to learn, you know, Mohammed Atta was on this flight, and this could have been prevented in essence because a report was filed. And then when I would learn 4 or 5 months later, just last fall, when the whistleblower from the Able Danger Military Intelligence Unit stood forward and said, wait a minute, we, the government, or at least a division of the government, had Mohammed Atta in our sights long before 9/11. The story takes a really macabre turn because you realize that if the government had Mohammed Atta in its sights, and if the government had been able to communicate with another arm of the government, the FAA, they would have been able to look at who these four Middle Eastern men were that were behaving in such a way that made a passenger, a very credible passenger, believe that the flight was going to be hijacked. And perhaps something could have been done to interrupt the terrible plot.
And the great tragedy is, of course, that nothing was done. And the question is, why do you ignore reports of this sort? Or was the report seen and intentionally shelved? We'll be right back here with Annie Jacobson. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Annie was simply telling that on this flight when James Wood was on, that there were four men, airmen, in the first class area, and James Wood was watching them. James Wood is an Emmy-winning actor, and he was convinced that they were going to hijack the plane. Now, this was several weeks before 9/11, and of course he reported this, and to the stewardesses reported to the pilots, and they said they would keep the door locked there during the rest of the flight. They filed a report, and a year later, when Annie was interviewed by people from the Office of Homeland Security, federal agents, they told her that the Mohammed Atta was on that flight with James Wood, and the report had gone in about these hijackers, these people that they assumed were going to be trying to hijack the plane or practicing for it, and this was exactly the same flight that was, of course, hijacked on September 11th. So the knowledge was there, the government knew it was Mohammed Atta, and the question is, why was that total incompetence or cluster? Well, anyway, you've had certainly people, pilots. Aren't many of the pilots very concerned because they have to block them from being able to pistol on that plane that they can use? So why they're required to put it in a locked climate? It would really, door to the cockpit is locked, have guns because they made it so difficult for them. But when they're going to go out, to go to the better way. So that if at that time they don't have any defense, that doesn't make any sense.
Division in government when sort of takes precedent and outweighs 1,000 good opinions. And the one bad opinion I'm referring to is that of Transportation Secretary Norman Mineta, who had a famous quote, which was when someone asked him why he felt pilots should not be allowed to be armed, he said that he wanted the pilots to, and I quote, be able to pay attention to what was going on. So it doesn't, it's, you know, it's just this idea that a pilot can only do one thing, which is kind of like steer a plane and nothing else, when of course there are two of them, it doesn't make any sense.
Well, of course, so much doesn't make any sense. You know, certainly the pilot, you know, is responsible for that plane. And if he thinks he should be armed and the co-pilot thinks they should be armed, why would one man, Norman Mineta, be able to block and do everything he could to circumvent the will of the people, to circumvent the will of the pilots, to circumvent the laws that have been passed by the Congress of the United States that have had passed several pieces of legislation demanding that the pilots allowed to be armed, and Norman Mineta and the bureaucracy continue doing everything to block efforts to protect the people on our planes. Just doesn't make sense.
Well, it doesn't make sense, but it seems to be, the more I write about it, read about it, research it, it seems to be the kind of golden rule of bureaucracy to be able to put these dumbfoundingly bad ideas, you know, push them through the system where they clog up that system, and the efforts to undo them become so unwieldy that it takes a tragedy for them to actually be undone.
Well, I wonder how many people will die because of Norman Mineta and these foolish things one day along the way here. Well, have you had a chance to talk to any of the pilots? Have you had a chance to talk to, you know, some of the stewardesses and other people? Have these people contacted you?
Absolutely. I mean, every time I write an article, I get an outpouring of feedback from people in the aviation industry. And it takes me to the next article I like to investigate where the holes are, which is brought to my attention by professionals who know this. And so, you know, it is an ongoing process, and it's really fascinating to listen to look at the examples with these new insane rules by the TSA. The TSA proposed these rules in September of this year, at which point many of the airline pilot associations and coalitions sent letters of outrage to Kip Hawley, who is the Secretary of the Transportation Security Administration, saying, what are you thinking? I mean, really in that kind of plain English. And the answer was, no answer. Instead, the TSA, well, I will say one thing. Originally back in September, the TSA was actually considering, I'm not kidding, I write about this in an article, they were actually considering letting throwing stars and bows and arrows on planes. And they decided to leave those out of the mix. So I hope that makes you feel better.
Well, sometimes I think we live in a world of gone mad, and other times I'm absolutely certain of it. We're going to be back here in just a couple of minutes with Annie Jacobson, her book, Terror in the Skies. And we do carry that. We think it's an important book. Our number, 1-800-544-8927, if you'd like to get it. Annie does a great job, and we'll be back in just a moment here. Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, and I know I've talked to the people in charge of the pilots union, and they tell me that they're just into the things that are being done to prevent the pilots from being able to be armed to protect the plane in case there was another attempt at hijacking. Now, fortunately, we haven't had another attempt that we know of since 9-1-1, but that doesn't mean if there really are terrorists out there that they're not going to try this. So what is this, Annie? If we live in a world gone mad, isn't there any way we can bring some sanity back into what's going on?
Well, you know, it's a tricky situation because I do believe in a solution, and I do believe in the idea of being hopeful about things, and I believe in being optimistic and working toward a solution and not just simply being part of the problem. And that's why I write what I do. It's interesting because I often write what I do about the problem so as to try to get to the solution. So it's a lot of verbiage and semantics, but what it really boils down to is this. People do make a difference. In my experience, people speaking up, speaking out, and sticking to a subject does eventually, you know, make change. The old squeaky wheel, oil it, and that's where the change happens. So I don't think we're as handicapped as some people feel that we are. I think the voice of the individual counts.
Well, I think it's important that you keep writing these articles. Now, how can people get your articles? Where would they find them? Where are they available?
Well, I write a regular column for womanswallstreet.com, and that is part of the Terror in the Skies series. And I'm also syndicated by the Creators Syndicate, so you can look for it in a lot of different newspapers.
All right, fine. So you can actually find Annie's articles in the various newspapers. And then it's women, W-O-M-E-N, wallstreet.com. Is that it?
That's right. Plural. Women's Wall Street.
Women's, okay. There's W-O-M-E-N-S, Wall Street, okay. womenswallstreet.com. And I'm going to go there because I'd like to see what the things that are happening. Because actually, you've learned an awful lot since you wrote the book, haven't you?
Oh, you bet. I mean, it's really an interesting experience of mine, sitting where I sit and writing what I write, I must say.
All right, fine. Well, you know, as far as what's taking place now, is there any legislation out there that is going to, be enacted or is being considered that will make it safer for the passengers on our planes? Now that, of course, we're allowing the six-inch screwdriver and the sharp scissors on board.
No, I'm afraid not. I'm afraid, actually, that things are really taking a turn for the worst in that regards. I mean, the handheld weapons back on planes from everybody I've spoken to across the board.
Hold that off right there, please, for just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and of course our guest is Annie Jacobson. If you'd like to read her articles, you can get them at www.womenswallstreet.com. That's women's, W-O-M-E-N-S, wallstreet.com, and you can certainly follow her articles, I think probably on financial as well as that, but she writes a series of articles on terror in the sky. And I was asking Annie if there's any legislation that's being enacted or being considered now to try to make it safer. Certainly, we've stood in these long lines, these interminable lines, and they go on and on and on. But now suddenly they've reversed themselves, and you can take your sharpened scissor weapons, or you can take your 6-inch screwdriver onto the plane. And believe me, a 6-inch screwdriver with a sharpened tip would be a very, very effective weapon. But that's perfectly all right. And when this was being considered, the pilots went ballistic. They said, why would you want to do that? But you see, there's so little logic to anything going on today. And of course, there are only a few of us, I think, who are still sane, and everybody else thinks we're crazy. Our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. If you'd like to chat to Annie, and her book, Terror in the Sky, really did have quite an impact. In fact, did you get any criticism from the government or from government agencies for writing that book?
Well, I'm always getting criticism from the government agencies, I must say. I'll share an interesting detail with you. When the FBI calls you, it shows up on your cell phone number as a bunch of zeros. And my phone is always filled with these 000s because they do call me. I write about the federal government on a regular basis, and someone's always calling me to find out, you know, wanting to quote read back to them and this, that, and the other thing. It's kind of a little bit of a contentious relationship, but you know, it is moving forward.
All right. Well, the thing is, there are a lot of good people who work for government. I'm convinced that the majority of them are good people who want to do a good job. But I think that they're hamstring, and I think that they really are probably very grateful that you're out there in the front line, and that they can get to you and get. The information to you and let you handle it. Well, our telephone number 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. And we have Ben calling in from Salinas. Ben, do you have a question for our guest?
Yes, I have a two-part comment, sir. being a clear-thinking American, as I see myself to be, how can we reach any other conclusion that with all the data that has come out on these flights and what was known and agents that were shipped here and shipped there and ignored and classified, that there is only one conclusion that any reasonably intelligent American, clear-thinking Christian can think? Cheney, Bush, and Tennant all knew it was coming and let it happen, sir.
Well, now that's a little out of Annie's field of expertise, but I appreciate so much your thought on that, Ben, and I know Ben feels very, 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 very strongly about that, but I don't think we ought to want to open any can of worms. I think we want to talk with Annie about the things that she, you know, feels comfortable talking about. So basically, Chris, you the book has been out for what, about a year now?
No, just in September.
Oh, okay,
just fine. Just a couple months.
Okay, fine. Well, then we must have had you on one of the first...
Absolutely.
How is the book moving? Is it moving fairly well?
It's really moving well, and it's exciting because I've gotten some very interesting reviews from some unexpected folks, and I think that's excellent. You know, I did not write this book to win a popularity contest, and as you know, when I write my columns, I do get a lot of negative feedback. You know, I'm always accused of being a racist, which is so interesting to me that is where the thought process of some people go when you write about issues involving Middle Eastern terrorists. But I do stay out of other people's opinions of me and just move forward and try to stay focused on the positive things, which is that it's important to get the information out there.
Well, I'll tell you what, if I was a Middle Eastern man, a good patriotic American who had to be, happened to be from Syria or Lebanon, and I might even be a Muslim, I would want, of course, the people who were monitoring things to be absolutely certain there wasn't some Arab terrorist on that plane. And certainly, you know, it's the most natural thing in the world. Racial profile is nothing wrong as long as you don't do anything harmful to people, and you have to be realistic. I mean, the majority of the Islamic terrorists in the world are Islamic. So I think that we really need to be logical about it. We have to do what is logical. We can't stand in the way of the people doing their jobs who are trying to protect us. And it's not racism to be concerned, you know, because certainly how many of the 19 hijackers were not Islamic, and they all were coming from Arab countries. So it's unfortunate. I hope one day we can get back to the point where we can all live together in peace, but right now we're certainly not in that situation. So does the people who attack you, do they have any solutions at all, or they just want to attack you?
You know, it's a good question. I don't really know, but I think in general, as a whole, I think that the most positive changes can come out of not having an acrimonious relationship toward every single issue that comes up in the press. And I see so much of that happening right now, be it political, on any issue. Everyone seems to be taking sides, and of course, that's not going to move the situation forward. It'll be interesting to see what happens with the new Bin Laden tape that was just released this morning. You know, I always hope that both political parties and all the different religions that people enjoy here in America can unify and stay focused on the war on terror, because that's where I believe one the eye should be.
And I really believe that the vast majority of Muslims are good people who just want to raise their families and live their lives and be left alone. It's unfortunate that this is not the way that it is today, and you know, we there is this very conscious effort to turn American against American and Christian against Muslim and Muslim against Christian, and this is my concern, is that there's a growing hatred and animosity developing all throughout the world. We saw that, you know, with the Second World War, we were supposed to hate the Japanese and the Germans, and the First World War, we were supposed to hate the Germans, and certainly during the Korean War, we were supposed to hate the Koreans, and during the Vietnamese War, we were supposed to hate the Vietnamese, and now there's a growing effort to make us hate people just because they come from the Middle East, and they sort of look a little different than we do, and that's totally uncalled for. I share your concern, but you can almost see as if almost this whole thing is being orchestrated.
You're right, but you know, that's why we're here talking about it.
Well, that's why I do what I do 5 hours a day, and I'm sure you must be doing an awful lot of radio interviews as well.
You bet.
All right, fine. Well, now, what can the average person who hears this program You know, what can they do? Is there anything they can do? Is there anything that the average person can do other than get on the plane and look over everybody on board to make sure that there's no Middle Eastern there? And if there is a Middle Easterner, he's probably just wants to get to the destination, and he's as scared as you would be.
You know, I'm not sure that I know much about precautions to take, because I do firmly believe that the federal government should be doing that job. And the one thing I will say is, from the number of federal air marshals that I speak to, I have to say these guys and women are really the best and the brightest as far as the ones that I have interviewed. I mean, we're talking about true patriotic souls who have incredible law enforcement experience, who have dedicated their lives to be soldiers, to be SWAT team, to be in the various police departments, Border Patrol, Customs. I mean, the Federal Air Marshal Service is made up of this group of men and women who came together with this unified belief that keeping America's skies safe was their job, their duty, their honor, and something that they were going to take really seriously. And I so believe in that. I just find it really disheartening that bureaucracy ties that up. But here's an interesting thing. The director of the Federal Air Marshal Service, whom I have written about at great length, gave his resignation last week.
Well, one of the things you mentioned was that, you know, the air marshals really felt that they wanted to spend some time sitting, you know, in the waiting room, you know, where all the people were, so they could look around and get an idea who was going to be going onto that plane. That it was their job to be alert, to be informed, to have some idea who the people who were going to be on with them. Was there anybody they should watch, be specifically concerned about? I mean, certainly we're depending on them to protect us. Would you like to tell a little about their concern, how they are restricted from doing what they really think needs to be done to protect the passengers?
Absolutely. And of course, the surveillance time when the Federal Air Marshal Service was started right after 9/11, the surveillance time was something around 2 hours. That was the allotted amount of time that air marshals could be in the airport looking around in the boarding area and making notes of things and sending in what are called surveillance detection reports on their PDAs. But because of a numbers game, which the Federal Air Marshal Service is currently playing with Congress, trying to get the numbers up, trying to show how many flights are covered, many federal air marshals, if I'm not mistaken, the majority of federal air marshals, have had that surveillance time cut down, in some cases, to as little as 15 minutes. And as one federal agent explained it to me, that's not enough time to stop and tie your shoe, let alone survey who's going to be on a flight. And this is of great concern, because, in essence, you take away the surveillance, and what you have is an armed agent on a plane staring at the cockpit door. God forbid anything happen.
Well, now, do they usually work in twos? They're usually two air marshals. Now, you mentioned, of course, there are about 2,000 air marshals, and that's only, that leaves the vast majority of our planes without any air marshals on them. Is that correct?
It is, and the Air Marshal Service goes ballistic, no pun intended, over these numbers. And I did not release that number. The Christian Science Monitor reported it just a little before Christmas. And I actually support the release of that number, although I myself have specifically not done that for the year and a half I've been writing about the service, because I've been asked not to. But I support the fact that that number was released, because the air marshals are growing more and more concerned by the fact of how small that number is. And the reason that number is so small is because the air marshals are leaving the service in droves, because it is becoming an impossible place to work. And whether or not this will change with the resignation of the Federal Air Marshal Director remains to be seen. But many of the marshals I speak to are very hopeful that it will change.
Well, because one of the things that always intrigued me is that the requirement that the air marshal, you know, would wear a suit and a tie and a white shirt or something of the sort. But anyway, you would almost pick them out when you got onto the plane. There, obviously, is the federal air marshal, just because of his dress. And the last thing you would want to do is have them identified.
Absolutely. And this goes back to what we talked about in the beginning, which is that air marshals feel they are being looked at, they are being scoped out. I mean, I've spoken to air marshals who have reported Middle Eastern men, you know, specifically standing around in certain areas where air marshals are trying to, in their opinion, in the marshal's opinion, trying to determine who, in fact, the marshals are. And then not getting on those flights, which in and of itself is, you know, an offense. However, these things are being reported to the bureaucracy within the Federal Air Marshal Service, and nothing is being done. And so many marshals have been leaving for what they consider to be a safer job. I spoke to an air marshal just the other day, former SWAT team, dedicated soldier, federal air marshal, who left the service because he wanted he had suggested certain changes. The Federal Air Marshal Service said no. So he left the service for a safer job, and guess where that job is? It is in Iraq.
Oh, I don't know if that's a safer job, but anyway, you know, I think that, you know, it's, apparently, you know, it's terribly boring, you know, you got to sit there and flight after flight after flight after flight, but if you're not allowed time in between your flights so that you can at least see who may be on the plane, so you'll have some sort of a feeling for what's going on, and then you are really the target. If they know who you are, why, your life is in danger, and the life of everybody on that plane is in danger. So why would you have a routine dress on those people so you could walk through the plane? And of course, you ordinarily come in through the forward cockpit, through the forward door. You walk down the aisle, you go through the first class area, and you look around and you say, oh, there's the air marshal.
That's right. And there was a report in USA Today of one passenger doing exactly that. And the Federal Air Marshal Service answer to this person saying, oh, look, we have federal air marshals on board, was not to change the policy, but to they actually considered charging the passenger with a crime. And, of course, it's ridiculous because the problem isn't the passenger, it's the policy.
Amen to that. Well, let's go to Bill, who's calling us from Florida. Hi, Bill. Do you have a question for Annie?
Yes, I got a quick question, Dr. Stan. I wondered what your guest thought about various states have concealed carry weapons licenses where they do background checks and everything on the person and
okay.
They're allowed to carry a concealed weapon. Why wouldn't that be a helpful solution to add to the air marshals if these people were disclosed to the, you know, flight attendants, and they knew who was armed on the plane and who wasn't?
Do you have any thoughts at all about that?
Well, yes. I mean, I'm no arms expert, but I will share the opinion that I have taken from marshals is that it's, you know, in their opinion, not a good idea to have a bunch of armed Americans on a flight. There are other individuals who are armed on flights sometimes, and those are federal agents. But as far as regular passengers, civilians, getting on flights with guns, that I have been told is air marshals do not think that is a good idea. So that's the closest I can come to in my opinion.
And Bill, we live in a crazy world today, and we saw this instance recently where a man obviously was bipolar, he was having emotional problems, and of course he was running off the plane and yelling and shouting, and he was shot. The air marshals are taught to shoot people. I mean, this is the thing. Could you imagine what would happen if somebody was on that plane and they were not a danger at all, but somehow it became obvious they had a gun? Why, you know, the air marshal there is, he's to protect himself, he's to protect the plane, and you might very well get shot, you know, inadvertently. I think that, you know, when you got people who are jumpy and concerned, you know, I would tend to agree with Annie, and I believe people ought to have guns, but right now, until we can get some sanity back in the world, I'm against having everybody being armed on that plane.
Okay,
fine. We've just got a few more minutes here, because as going over some of the things that are in and that you've actually been told, what about the stewards? Are they concerned about what's going on today? Have they by Middle Eastern men to see?
And I write about some of those instances in the book. Again, prohibited from speaking to any members of the press and far between, but I have many, many flight attendants telling me of probing instances on planes, and, you know, I have to tip my hat to these flight crew because they work so hard. Can you imagine going to work on a regular basis and having to deal with this kind of threat?
That's one reason why I do what I do. Anyway, let's one more time. It's Annie Jacobson, her book, Terror in the Skies. If you'd like to get it, it's 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR at our website, www.womenswallstreet.com. That's womenswallstreet.com. Hang on a moment. Here at Radio. This is Dr. Stan. We have just three more minutes, Annie, before we... You know, this it really is a very, very important issue, and I think that you have really dramatized it, because I think people have to understand what's going on today just doesn't seem to make sense. Now, on your flight that you were on, it actually released them immediately, and then did they follow up on them to find out who they really were or where they were going? Something they were said about they being musicians and that's why they were traveling together?
Well, you know, the government did none of that, which was so alarming. I, on the other hand, while reporting, I spoke to a number of the different quote-unquote promoters, and nothing added up. I write about this in the book. And most alarming of all, I actually got a photograph of Norma Hanna, the popular Arab singer that these men called back a band for. I got a photograph of Mahena and his 15-person band, and the men as a group are not the same. And that is very disturbing. I wrote about this in a column, and I was surprised that I received a call from the government wanting to see the photograph.
They wanted to see the photograph that you had?
That I had.
In other words, you would think the FBI, with all the hundreds of millions and billions of dollars it has for counterterrorism, to get a picture.
Absolutely. And the picture, by the way, I did get off of the web.
Well, there's so many things going on out there. Well, I see you're still being, you mentioned you're still being regularly contacted by the...
Well, you see, I write about different federal agencies. I continue to write about these abominable situations which continue, you know, pulled over, foos that are remarkably similar to the shooter Reed and test positive for explosives, and lo and behold, federal agents are not called in other than the TSA screeners. And I write about this, and I try to examine, okay, let's try to establish what went wrong here. Why on earth wasn't Department of Homeland Security called in to discuss what was going on with this?
Same name as an international adult throughout the world.
He has the same name of the lead officer up the United States.
He's wearing a pair of shoes with wires, and they keep the shoes, and they let him go?
And they let the man go. Now, the man could be very innocent. We don't know. The FBI tells us that he was, but that the situation is still under. But it is alarming. This is how one federal agent said to me, Annie, you've got a pair of shoes that test positive. You've got Egypt on it.
Hold that thought for just a moment here. I want to listen to... Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Annie was telling about this story she's heard about. That this is a man who, he has a passport strapped Egypt. Stamped Egypt. He is actually has the name of an internationally known Arab terrorist. He is wearing a pair of shoes with wires sticking out. They take his shoes off. They three times and they test positive. Do you want to tell the rest of the story?
They keep the man's shoes. They let him go, and it only 6 days later, after the marshals in Miami, at which point marshals were on alert because in New York, 5 days prior. Then the ASCOVER has been on this manhunt now for this 50-year-old Egyptian man and a student at the University of Iowa, and they track him down and they say, you know, he's not a threat, it was a mistake. And my job is to try to find out what went wrong. And of course, the FBI is very tight-lipped on the details of what went wrong, because in their opinion, nothing went wrong.
I see. Well, I mean, how many people do have shoes that test positive for explosives, have wires sticking out of them, and they just happen to have... the major international terrorist. Well, Annie,
on that note, what can we say?
God bless you. Thanks so much for being with us. It's always a pleasure.
Thank you.
Good night. Bye-bye. All right, well, that's Annie Jacobson, and certainly one of my favorite guests, a real pleasure to have on our program. And she's on the front lines writing about this. Go to her website. That's www.womenstreet.com. And, of course, order her book from Radio Liberty, Radio Liberty. And, of course, we've nothing... here we are. Have air marshals on every plane. The people take weapons onto the plane. The government breaches our borders, refuses to allow any sort of deflectors on the plane to protect them from surface-to-air missiles, will not do anything about our chemical plants. We have 15,000 chemical plants in America. Any one of them could be attacked by these wicked terrorists. And of course, with deaths of hundreds or thousands or tens of thousands of Americans, because some of these are very, very close to our cities, and yet no effort is being made to guard them. Now, what's wrong with this pick? Is it possible that everything we really is not true? And this is our contention website and pulpit. We had our four tape one update. Interviews with Paul Thompson, who wrote letters, who spent millions of dollars, page ads in the New York Times and major newspapers and on television in New York. You really need, of course, to get much of the 3 words, 911, part one, part two, part three, you nation. And then you begin to think about it. Is it possible that everything I believe is not true? Is it possible that what I saw that day I didn't see? You really need to get a video we have. It's we're the only people I know that have it. It's called the America Forever, Video Prophecy Club, prior if it's called 911 prior. And then, of course, you would want to get my Inside Job by Tex Mars, The War on Freedom, all the books we carry. Just go to our webinar newsletters and then try to get other people to begin to challenge, why is it, if everything is a major attack in America, airs over 4 years, or is it possible that's true? Is it possible that our minds are molded, are adjusted by the people who control our media and control our reality? Our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927. Pray for America. Pray for revival. Pray for Radio Liberty.